all of us. Everyone at the State's Academic Medical Center. All working together to deliver complete care now and for generations to come. All over the state, including hospital and clinic locations from the Delta to the Gulf Coast. All for one reason. You, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. All for your health.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Do you drive a vehicle? Then you'll find autocorrect helpful, especially on Coach Charlie's Tip of the Week. Listen to our podcast with me, Coach Charlie Melton, on any podcasting platform or on the MPB Public Media app.
Good morning and welcome to Southern Remedy. This is Dr. Jimmy Stewart, Professor of Internal Medicine and Pediatrics at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. And this is your Southern Remedy program where you can call in with any type of medical question about any type of medical issue that either yourself or someone in your family or even a friend is experiencing right now. That's right. Send us an email if you're not able to call. That email address is remedy@mpbonline.org. What a great spring day that we're having right now. A little overcast, a little hot yesterday, and a little bit more humid today. Just reminding us of where we are in the South, right? But I hope you're having a great time. I've been discussing with a lot of my patients that I'm seeing, hey, this is the time that you've been waiting for to get outside and to get busy doing those things that are going to be both enjoyable and also beneficial to your health. And we know that getting more information about that is always good, whether you're dealing with preventative medicine type topics, what kind of immunizations would be most appropriate for your age and for your risk factors, or if you have chronic diseases that you're dealing with, like hypertension, diabetes, or coronary artery disease, chronic kidney disease, all those things, autoimmune diseases. What kind of things do you need to know about those? And there's all kinds of information out there. Sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not so good and not so accurate. So you have to be a little bit careful with that. But we view ourselves as just an extension of that information that you can get about all those topics and more. We certainly are not your primary physician that you see, but we can point you in the right direction. So if you have a question about a symptom that you've been having, something that's just sort of a question in the back of your mind, or maybe it's a new medication that you're taking, maybe it's a new diagnosis that you didn't quite understand when your physician gave you that, you can call in right now by dialing 1-877-MPB-RING. That's 1-877-672-7464. I mentioned immunizations. We tend to think of those with kids, but they are important for adults too, particularly for certain illnesses that we see pop up from time to time. I think everybody is used to the idea of getting a tetanus shot every 10 years. You probably didn't know that you can get that as a separate shot, but there's also something called pertussis and diphtheria that are often combined with that. And there's some reasons for doing that, because as you get older, you tend to lose immunity to those kinds of things, particularly to pertussis and tetanus. And whether or not you are having any kind of symptoms for anything, you don't want to get those diagnoses. A lot of people would say, well, isn't it healthier just to get the actual disease in your immunity better? That is not the case. That's one of those false things that are out there that sometimes people read about. But immunity is actually a little bit better with most of the things we immunize against with the immunization and not a natural immunity with it. Now, certainly if you're exposed to it, it can increase that immunity over time. But you certainly don't want to get things like pertussis or diphtheria or tetanus. And sometimes if you wait until you've gotten those, some of those are actually fatal. But that is something that you need about every 10 years. And then there's other things. As we get older, our immune system is not as good as it used to be. And we are more susceptible to things like pneumonia. So a pneumonia just means an inflammation or infection of the lungs, and it can be caused by a number of things. You can have a viral pneumonia, and that tends to be more self-limiting. We usually don't treat those with antibiotics. But bacterial pneumonias can be caused by a number of organisms that don't normally live in the lungs, or they live in the lungs, and there's problems when you have an overgrowth of those. One of the more common ones is called pneumococcus, and that is a type of bacteria. And it is very common as an infectious agent in the very young, the very old, and the immunocompromised. In other words, those individuals whose immune systems are not working quite as well for various reasons. And we've been very successful with treating, particularly in childhood, pneumococcal diseases, so that pneumococcus is no longer the number one cause of those types of infections in the lung or with meningitis or other infections with pneumococcus. But also in the elderly, as you get older, around about 65, if you don't have any problems, or if you have lung disease, kidney disease, diabetes, those kinds of things that would put you at risk. And a lot of people don't quite know that they might be at risk even for having something as common as diabetes, that getting a pneumococcal vaccine is probably a good thing starting at age 65. There's a couple that are out there. The newest one is called a PCV, pneumococcal vaccine 20. And there's different varieties of pneumococcus. Not every pneumococcal bacteria is the same. So there's about 20 different varieties of those or strains of those. And this one covers, well, there's actually more than that, but this one covers the most common causes of pneumonia in those 20. So just something to think about. Ask your physician about it. Actually, you can just ask your pharmacist about it, where you get your medications from, and they can give you that. You just have to present your insurance card there to them and ask them about that if you would qualify. Pharmacists are great extensions of our healthcare system and can certainly do a lot of things to help you get access to things, so you don't have to maybe sit in a waiting room for something like an immunization where you're exposed to other people who might be sick. This is Southern Remedy. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning, answering your calls and questions about any kind of healthcare issue you might have. You know, speaking of people who are listening and have the ability to call during the hour, and again, our email address for those questions you might have, or maybe it's a longer question or you just didn't have quite enough time to call it in, is remedy@mpbonline.org. But as far as listening, if, you know, a lot of people will tell me, hey, I wish I could listen to you, but I'm sort of busy during that hour. You can listen to us through your favorite podcasting app or online. You just search for Southern Remedy, MPB Think Radio on your podcasting app, or you can go online to mpbonline.org, just search for Southern Remedy. We do archive all of our programs, so you can go back and catch maybe a portion that you didn't hear or the entirety of it at your leisure. So that's another way that we can get that information out there so that you can listen to it whenever you want. I know I listen to a couple of different podcasts from time to time, usually while I'm driving. So hopefully that's not too much of a distraction.
Yeah, and Dr. Jimmy, they can also leave a talk to us message. So if they didn't want to type out an email, they can go on the MPB Public Media app, search for that, and then you can actually click on the Southern Remedy on Talk to Us. You'll click on the Talk to Us feature, click Southern Remedy, and they can literally leave you a voicemail, and we can play that on air.
Wow, that is excellent. I actually did not know that.
Yep.
So that's just another way. Thank you, Jermaine.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it's just another way that you can access us directly with your questions. It's always good to hear the voice, too. I love doing that. Like, it's nice to read things on the email, but it's nice to hear that voice as somebody, you know, it sort of conveys more. No, in person, we can't really do that yet. But
no, we can.
But
we can actually feel your pain,
right,
when you talk to us.
No. Right, exactly. Yeah, that always comes up with rashes and skin problems. Like, how well can you describe it? I did have in training, it's very interesting. So at a portion of my training as a resident, you know, you go through 4 years of medical school after college, and then you have your residency, which is additional on-the-job sort of training as you're seeing patients. Well, at the time, our dermatologist at the medical center was out, but was available. And she trained me to describe different rashes and skin lesions. And I was on my dermatology rotation, so I would, she'd sort of quiz me on that up front. It's like, this is how you describe these to me. And she was so good that I could describe the lesions. This is way before we could send pictures, you know, or text and those kinds of things. Yeah. Those help out a lot with dermatologic problems now. But I would just describe it over the phone, and she would tell me exactly what it was, what to do, those kinds of things, and sort of what the next step would be. So,
well, Doc, I may have one for you.
Oh, go ahead.
So it happened maybe when I was maybe my mid-20s. For some reason, I diagnosed myself with eczema on my legs. There were small patches that would come up, and they would be dry and kind of scaly looking. And then for me, I'm brown skinned, so for some reason, they would be like two shades darker than what my skin color is anyway in those spots. And over time, it's actually grown to the point to where I'm thinking now, I'm just like guessing now, is it psoriasis? I have it on the fronts and the backs of my legs. It flares up really bad during the winter. It kind of calms down during the summer, but I'm still having to, like, I'm going through lotions and creams and different things. And so I'm not quite sure what it is. It itches from time to time. So I'm sometimes scratching my calves a lot. So I don't know. I don't know. I haven't been to a dermatologist. I know it's a thing, especially with versus African-American skin versus Caucasian skin, what the two differences could be in this rash. But that's my issue.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And you described that wonderfully. Thank you, Jermaine. So, so it does sound like eczema or atopic dermatitis. It tends to in adults, at least, you can see it in what we call flexural areas. So that would be on the back of the knees. Front of the knees, a little bit different spot for that, but that's not too terribly out of the ordinary. Yeah. Now, you mentioned, like, is this, you know, differentiating between eczema and psoriasis.
Yeah.
Psoriasis affects a little bit a different part of the skin layer. So it tends to be, you can see that over like your knees or your elbows. Usually it's in places that the skin has a lot more wear and tear. So if you think about it, you know, we always have our elbows, you know, we have weight on them. Same thing with your knees, and just because they're flexing. So that part of it does sound like it might be psoriasis, but the way you're describing it, certainly that it still could be eczema. Sometimes a small biopsy of the area, usually the edge of the area, can help a dermatologist sort of see that. The other thing is if the top layer of it, oftentimes if it bleeds,
it could. I mean, in between the cracks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it may be that you just need a little bit more aggressive, not over the counter, but some topical steroids to it, and maybe a couple other things to sort of see if it's eczema. Now, psoriasis, sometimes there are some other what we call keratolytic that it may seem a little bit counterintuitive, but psoriasis sort of is a buildup of those layers on the skin, and you have to like slough those off over time. Mm-hmm. And some of the agents that we use for psoriasis, there's not really a good over-the-counter one with that. But a good biopsy would be the best thing because it's going to show you exactly where the problem is. So yours is sort of an overlap by what you're saying because it does have some components of eczema. Mm-hmm. It itches. Mm-hmm. It occurs during winter months. That fits. The air is usually drier, and you may be being exposed to some things during that time that you're not at other times of the year.
Okay.
But a dermatologist is probably a good idea just to take a look at it. And again, an experienced dermatologist oftentimes does not have to do a biopsy. That's not something to totally expect. But it can give you the definitive diagnosis. Mm-hmm. They may want to, you know, they may be 90% sure that it's either one of those and say, hey, we can do a targeted therapy for a you know, for a few weeks and see if that improves the symptoms. But
do you recommend me go to a dermatologist who would be more inclined on African American skin, or could it be either or?
Yeah, so the way, you're right, it does look a little bit different in people of color versus Caucasians,
yeah.
And sometimes even depending on what your ethnicity is too. So sometimes people who are originally from Southeast Asia or from Africa can have a little bit differences even amongst those two groups. But generally speaking, most dermatologists are going to be trained to deal with mm-hmm. both of them.
Okay.
Certainly you'd want to pick somebody that you would be comfortable with. Dermatologists, oftentimes you can get in with them directly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would, or you might need a referral, just sort of depends.
Okay.
But yeah, I think a dermatologist, particularly with the symptoms that you're having, should be able to differentiate about what is actually going on and understand the differences in how that might look differently in different people.
Okay. Thanks, Doc.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. This is Southern Remedy. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning. You can always email us. We may get to a couple of emails in just a few minutes if we don't have callers. That email address is remedy@mpbonline.org. If that was an unfamiliar voice on Southern Remedy earlier, that was Jermaine Flood, who's stepping in for our producer, Kevin Farrell. And always, yeah, everybody's great with questions at MPB. I must say, like, everybody's like, hey, what about this? I was like, you know what? Can I share that on the air? That would be really good. So thank you, Jermaine, for being here and keeping me in line this morning.
Thanks, Doc.
It takes a team, I'll tell you. I got an email here from one of our listeners, and it's about antibiotic dosing, and we could really talk about dosing as it relates to other medications in other, you know, because dosing just refers to when do you take it during the day. And the easiest medication to take is once a day, right? So that's the easier one. And usually you'd want to take that at the same time. But here's the question. My doctor put me on an antibiotic and asked me to take them every 6 hours. I'm planning on taking them at 6:30 a.m., 12:30 p.m., and 6:30 p.m. every day until the pills are finished. Will that suffice? Also, should I plan on waking up at 12:30 a.m. to take a pill? If I use a 3 pills per day plan but happen to be already awake, should I take a pill at 12:30 a.m. or is it best to keep it consistent? So I'm guessing this person might be an engineer, but I love my patients that are engineers. They bring me spreadsheets of all their labs and all their symptoms and everything, but they tend to be very meticulous with things. So dosing of different medications is designed based on the medication to deliver it to the tissue where you want it. And you have to think about things like absorption, of how well it's absorbed in the GI tract. And how, or if it's, you know, inhaled for that reason, for that matter, I mean, there's a lot of things that are either on the skin or, as we talked about, dermatologic conditions earlier, and then for pulmonary, for lung type conditions, sometimes inhaled medications are the same way. But anyway, to get it to where you need it, it has to be absorbed if you swallow it. It has to be sometimes metabolized by the body. And it has a distribution in the body's systems. And sometimes some medications are in different parts of the body. In other words, it's harder to get them into different parts. It's why not every antibiotic can be used to treat every, you know, condition. So if you have a condition where that antibiotic needs to get into places a little bit harder, sometimes you have to use a higher dose. Sometimes you have to use multiple day dosing, or it might be that that medication is broken down faster than other medications. So 4 times a day is a lot if it's every 6 hours. Now, I would try to just spread that out. Generally speaking, you don't want people waking up. I know some ophthalmologists, particularly with eye conditions, I know a good friend of mine, their mother had a severe eye infection. And they sort of would wake her up during the night and do this every 2 to 3 hours. Barring that, most medications you can do it while you're awake. So if you're awake for 16, 18 hours a day, maybe even a little bit longer than that, you can just spread it out 4 times a day during that time period. You don't have to wake up in the middle of the night to do that. It's extremely difficult. And that's also a reason why we should try, and granted, there's sometimes you can't get away with this. We should try to use medications that you only have to use once or twice a day. I find it very, very difficult for patients to take medications more than twice a day. You have to, usually you're carrying medications around with you if you're not at home all day long. So it is a little bit difficult to do that. But I wouldn't overthink it. I think in this case, I would just, you know, just do four times a day. If you wake up at 6 and you go to bed at 8, split the time difference into four, take it when you wake up, take it when you go to sleep, and maybe do it two times in between that are equally spaced out. So consistency is important. And the other thing is, even in patients that take things once a day, they'll ask me, hey, if I take it at 8 o'clock at night every day, but then I miss it and then it's like 11 o'clock at night and I remember, do I still take it or do I wait? Most medications, you just take it when if it's within about 3 or 4 hours, that's probably going to be okay. The other thing to keep in mind is some medications, they are so long in how they stay in your body. Once you build up enough of it in your body in a consistent rate, and blood pressure medications are a good example of this, and particularly the ones we have, some of the newer ones we have now. Once you miss a dose, it really doesn't typically decrease the amount that you have in your body enough to where it's going to cause a significant problem. So you don't need to freak out about it. Certainly ask your pharmacist or ask your physician. But generally speaking, as long as you're within a couple of hours, maybe 3 or 4 hours of when you normally take it, that should be fine. But great question to ask. This is Southern Remedy. The number to call is 1-877-MPB-RING. That's 1-877-672-7464. Let's go to Greg from Columbus.
Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing, Greg?
I'm doing okay. For years, the inner part of my diet, sort of like toward the bottom, there is, I don't know if it's a ligament or a muscle, it continues to stay sore from the bottom of my buttocks all the way to the back of my neck. And I didn't know, you know, I've always thought it's just right, it was just normal. But the more that I put pressure on it, the more it starts hurting. So I didn't know, you know, that deal on that. That's the purpose of this call.
Yeah. So there's a couple of muscles that are back there and other structures. And sometimes you can have soreness there for good reasons. One of the most common ones is if you're, particularly if it happens after sitting on it or putting pressure on the nerve, like the sciatic nerve that's on the, that would be up towards your buttocks. Over time, that can cause some pain down the backside of your leg. Another reason might be if you have really tight hamstrings, you can have constant soreness just because they're being stretched a little more. So actually, it's sort of counterintuitive, but stretching them out and giving you a fuller range of motion might help. You can have some cutaneous nerves. Those are the smaller nerves, not the big sciatic nerve, that innervate different places. And maybe there's something pushing on one or more of them. A good exam, including seeing you walk, seeing how limber you are, how much range of motion you have in your hip joints and your knee joint, and then perhaps even getting some x-rays. That is a little bit different distribution from, say, a problem in the joint that at least I'm aware of, but either in the hip joint or the knee joint. And but, you know, a physician may want to get some x-rays. If you had all those things, you know, thinking about, you can get focal soreness in muscles from things like low potassium, low magnesium, and those are easy things to check, you know, and easy things to replace if they are low. If it's normal, though, you know, a supplement is not going to help you much. The other thing is, a lot of people will get focal muscle soreness and sometimes cramping when they get a little bit dehydrated. So staying hydrated throughout the day may help out. And we don't really understand why some people would get like a soreness in their arm muscle or a soreness in their leg muscle or in their side with the muscle when they're dehydrated. But that's something else that can frequently do that. Who's a physician that really specializes in this? A couple come to mind. One would be a sports medicine physician. And these are individuals that are trained, usually either orthopedic surgery trained or occasionally sort of medical trained, to sort of tease out these things to sort of see if they can get a reason for why you're having the soreness. And then the other person might be a neurologist if the sports medicine person says, I don't think that you have anything going on here. But that's sort of the direction I would take. If it's been going on that long, I bet it's not an electrolyte problem, and it may not be the hydration problem. It may just be something anatomical that's happening, then that might could be fixed, Greg. So I might reach out to them.
Okay, I appreciate that. Love y'all show, man. Very informative.
Oh, thank you, Greg.
Guys, have a good day.
We appreciate you listening. Care. Cramps are nasty things. I have one every time I get hot and I run at about 30 to 40 minutes in, and it tends to happen more in the afternoon if I'm running. It's like my right side, right around where my liver is. It's not my liver, it's the muscles in between my ribs. But and I've learned over time how to sort of relax that area and just sort of think about it. Sometimes I'll put my hand there. You know, everybody's a little bit different. We tell medical students and residents all the time, you know, your patient didn't always read the textbook, so they may deviate from that from time to time.
Doc, now I get those cramps, but I call them I didn't work out cramps. It sounds like you work out on the regular. And when I work out and run, I get it right underneath the rib, but I call it the I didn't work out or breathe right cramp.
Yeah, they can happen. It can happen. The old Charlie horse, right?
Yeah.
So that's certainly something that that can affect you. This is Southern Remedy. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning. The number to call if you have a question is 1-877-MPB-RING. That's 1-877-672-7464. We're going to go to Ken from Madison. Good morning, Ken.
Hey, Dr. Jimmy. Long time listener, first time caller.
All right.
So I struggle a lot with acne, and I was on doxycycline, and I developed a doxycycline resistant infection, and we're trying to treat that with gentamicin. And then unusually, February, a year and a half ago, started ligament tearing in my wrist. And you know, almost everybody's like, that's completely unrelated to acne.
Right, right.
But later on, we sort of figured out. I tried azathioprine. I tried mucaptopurine. There's like a smoldering type of acne infection in my ears. So I've seen rheumatology and seen ID. But you know, they're like you never could be treated. You could sort of minimize the cycles with bleach baths.
Right.
But I've seen ear, nose, and throat surgeons, and they're sort of suspicious of a cartilage infection.
Right.
But they absolutely do not want to biopsy the cartilage.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm sort of stuck in between a lot of different set specialists, seen dermatology, seen rheumatology, seen infectious diseases.
Yeah, you've definitely seen all the people. So, yeah, sometimes we run into this problem with either, unfortunately, in some areas of the body, infections and autoimmune processes can sort of look the same. And they can cause an inflammatory response that is similar. So it sounds to me like that's sort of what they, you know, there are some things around your ear like relapsing chondritis that is more of an autoimmune type thing, but it can look like an infection. And it is sometimes very hard to treat and very hard to diagnose. You're definitely right that biopsying cartilage is usually a bad idea just because it doesn't heal back very well and you end up with more problems. Cartilage doesn't have a whole lot of blood supply except around the cells on the edges of it. So it's really, it's hard to treat infections of that and it's hard to get it to, it really doesn't repair well at all. So once you lose it, you really don't gain it back. So it is very frustrating. Now, as far as like antibiotics, I'm assuming a lot of these they were treating topically, or was that something that you were taking by mouth?
They tried 10 days of levofloxacin, but you know, IV, they're probably the, you know, the
specialists said most likely not to give you anything until they prove stuff.
Right.
Now, I did bamboozle the wrist surgeon, so he took deep synovial biopsies.
Yeah.
All the cultures came back clean, but, you know, the tissue was fibrous. So, like, it's been going on for, like, a year and a half. All the cartilage in my body feels like it's, you know, cracking, popping. The pathology was fibrous tissue in the cartilage. But, like, it's, you know, sort of like, you know, it's really hard to get into rheumatologists, and it's really hard to get into rheumatologists in larger cities.
Right, right. Yeah, that does sound more like a systemic problem to me then, rather than just, you know, you would think if it was an infection, it would be just in the ear. But if it sounds like maybe this is something that's going on systemically. I know you've seen a lot of people, have you seen a geneticist?
No, I haven't seen a geneticist.
I mean, that may be somebody to consider, just because they are trained to look for different things. And I know there are a lot of connective tissue disorders and muscle disorders. And sometimes that can be where the tendons and muscles come together, and sometimes it can be a fibrous tissue. By what you're telling me of the biopsies, to me this is sounding more like a problem with the tissue itself that is breaking down and causing some inflammation at the site, so, or multiple sites. That probably, you know, they're very rare for one thing, and you need somebody that looks at a whole lot of these things. I know we used to have a neurologist here in the metro area of Mississippi that did a lot of muscle myopathies. So there's sort of a subset of neurologists that just look at the muscular, type disorders. And also worked with geneticists too to sort of tease out some of the things. We've gotten really good at our genetic arrays. If you have symptoms, not for everybody if you didn't have symptoms, but to try to pinpoint exactly what's going on, it may be worthwhile to reach out, since it sounds like you've sort of exhausted most of your local physicians and what's going on, to reach out regionally to somewhere like Mayo or you know, to sort of ask some of those experts, hey, this were your family member, where would you send me for a second opinion? And you're not going to offend them. That's going to be something that they're going to be fine with. But I think with this many people looking at you, you might need somebody with a lot more expertise that's sort of the regional expert rather than local.
Thank you.
All right, Ken, hang in there. I know that's a frustrating, it sounds like, your pathway right now, but that might be some different directions to go in. And we do appreciate you listening all these years to Southern Remedy. This is Southern Remedy. On Wednesdays, we tend to take all calls as they come in about any kind of healthcare topic that you might be interested in. I had a question from a patient this week and said, I feel like they got diagnosed with a cold, but they were confused because they thought that colds or viruses that cause colds were only seasonal and during the winter months. So you actually can get a viral infection, which, you know, usually causes, might cause a little bit of fever, stuffy nose, cough. You might even have some increased mucus production. All those things are sort of go along with those viral syndromes, particularly upper respiratory infections like that. And these are caused by lots of different viruses. They're the adenoviruses, the enteroviruses, the rhinoviruses. And all of these, typically they do sort of have a pattern seasonally during the year that they occur. Now, it doesn't have much to do with cold or temperature. You know, there was a lot of conjecture I hear from time to time saying, well, when it gets hotter, it kills off all the viruses. Not really true. If you think about it, what temperature is your body? 98.6. So if it's 98 degrees outside, not really going to do much. And as opposed to colder months. It's just when it's colder, we tend to be more congregated together and inside. And that those conditions really make it easier for us to transmit things back and forth to one another. So we're the problem. It's not necessarily the cold or the time of year. But they do tend to sort of follow certain patterns. The thing about it now, though, is there's so much travel and people are a lot more mobile than they used to be. It's not uncommon to have flu season extended into summer months, for instance, although it still has sort of that similar pattern, but it is extended in length. And anytime we change what we do, COVID was a good example of this. We saw different patterns of illnesses. RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, is a common virus that usually affects the younger pediatric patients, but it can manifest as sort of a common cold-like symptoms. It just sort of is persistent and causes a lot of coughing in adults. But that's a good example. During COVID, we saw that extended, and we've seen it throughout the year. When it used to be about the time that the fair came to Mississippi in October, we'd see RSV sort of ramp up and then progress till about February or March. Now we're seeing a little bit different times of the year, just because of the way travel is now and the way people are sort of interacting with each other. So you can get that. It's not just during a certain times of the year. Let's go to Curtis on the radio right now. Good morning, Curtis.
Good morning.
What's your question?
Yes, I was calling about when I was younger, I was playing ball, and I pulled my groin muscle, and I didn't go to the doctor for it. But now I'm old, I'm like 60-year-old, and it still bothers me at times.
Yeah, so earlier injuries can sort of set you up to injuries later on. Now, the groin muscle, so there's a like a basically it's you know, that movement of your leg coming in, you know, closer to the midline. That's what its job is. So it's the fancy name for it that we learned in medical school is adductors, ADD, like you're adding back to your body. And those adductor muscles, there's a couple that are the main ones that do that. You can pull that muscle just like you're pulling any other muscle. And that's really just some micro tears in the muscle itself or the tendons that attach to the bone. And it takes a while to heal up. What you can be left with, though, is a scar that's more susceptible to injury later on. So you might want to ask your physician about a quick visit to a physical therapist. Probably only once or twice is all you'd need. I bet they can show you some things to do to help prevent that, because usually it's from the muscle either is too tight and is getting stretched when you do certain movements, or the muscle's weak and it needs to be sort of beefed up with some specific exercises to it.
So should I have went to the doctor when I pulled that muscle when I first did it? Should I have went to the doctor or what?
It's hard to say. I mean, I don't think you did anything wrong necessarily. Usually, if you've got something like a pulled muscle anywhere, including the groin, if it goes away after about a week or two, probably not a big deal. It's probably just that you sort of favored it afterwards and it sort of shortened up. And my guess is that, and maybe some scar tissue that's there, it just needs to have sort of a physical therapy type program to it to sort of lengthen it out and strengthen it up a little bit. And you're probably going to have less problems with it doing that.
If I move a certain, you know, if I move it a certain way, it's like, ooh.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? It hurts. Like.
Yep. That's stretching those tissues to the point where you're starting to get those sort of tears. So I'd get a physician to look at it, maybe even a sports medicine physician if, you know, yeah, I don't know of any. There's some good doctors in Collins, and certainly there's a couple of sports medicine people in Hattiesburg that you could see. I'd check into that and then see if they can't, after they have a, sometimes you can diagnose those little micro tears or scar tissue with an ultrasound probe. That's just something that, you know, you just put on the skin and allows them to see in there. It doesn't hurt or anything. But I bet they're probably going to go with physical therapy to it, and I bet you're going to feel better.
All right. Thank you, then.
Yes, sir. Thank you for calling in. Thank you for listening. This is Southern Remedy. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning. Injuries like that are very common, and sometimes a previous injury decades before can sort of set up that muscle or tendons or joint for more damage. And I had, you know, a little bit of pushback a couple of weeks ago from a patient on physical therapy thinking, well, I don't understand how this is going to help me. They're just going to show me how to do exercises, and they sort of blow it off. It is extremely useful and can be very beneficial. Most patients are surprised because they don't think they're going to get any benefit, or they think that maybe it's too far gone. But a really good targeted physical therapy program can really benefit older injuries and allow you to still have mobility and decrease pain over time. A lot of people sort of resist it from the standpoint of pain. They'll say, you know, I just don't want to. It's way too painful right now to do any kind of physical therapy. But if you can start, and they're trained to basically, you know, get you into a program where they can help increase that mobility and limit pain while you do it. My physical therapist one time, a great one, said, kiss the pain. In other words, you get right up to it, but you don't get over that point where it's too painful. But they're really trained to help that muscle and that joint be a stronger, more functional joint to allow you to do what you normally would do. So check it out if you've had a previous injury or a new injury like that. Again, if it's more than about 2 weeks, if you have loss of mobility, those are all good reasons to go get it checked out. Let's go to Aaron from Gulfport. Good morning, Aaron.
Hi there.
What's your question?
You probably have gotten this question a lot, and I'm in the medical field myself, but I still get confused about bacterial infections versus viral infections. I mean, I'm a little nasally right now. I feel like I have a reoccurring sinus infection,
mm-hmm.
but I blow out the green stuff and I cough up the green stuff. So I'm not sure if that means it's bacterial and I should have an antibiotic, or if it's, is that still signs of a virus? If it's just a respiratory virus, I kind of just get confused with that.
Yeah, and it is confusing because we don't have very good mechanisms of differentiating between those two. So sinus infections are one of those that, or sinusitis, can be very difficult to differentiate between the two. And all the things, you know, I've heard physicians even say, you know, if the mucus is green, that's an infection. It doesn't really correlate very well. The problem is we always have bacteria that you can, you know, if you do cultures of what's coming out of your sinuses, you're going to have bacteria in that. We have bacteria in our nasal passages and our throats all the time. So oftentimes it's an overgrowth of that. And once you get that system draining appropriately, a lot of times you don't have to use an antibiotic, even if it is a bacterial overgrowth. In other words, if it sits in that sinus cavity and it's not draining out, yeah, you're going to have an infection there eventually, a bacterial infection. Now, you can have one after the other. So, for instance, if you get a viral infection that causes an increased amount of mucus production, that causes those tissues to swell up inside your nasal passages around where those sinuses are, then 10 to 14 days later, if it doesn't clear up and they're not draining appropriately, now you've got the bacterial infection, which
that
you...
makes sense because, yeah, that makes sense. Because about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I had the same thing. I took a plane trip and I thought I kicked it. And now I have, you know, the sinus stuff again. I'm like, gosh, maybe I just didn't. And I was on medicine before.
Yep.
I was on like Augmentin before. But now I'm like, maybe I just didn't kick it. And I've been using my neti pot like, you know, in the morning and in the evening. And I see this. It's amazing. You see the stuff just coming out, right?
Right.
And even when it's clear, like I get clear runs of it.
Yeah.
And then the next morning, I still have some. And it's just like, when is it going to stop? That's why I'm wondering if I need antibiotics again.
Yeah, so, usually that if you look at the guidelines, it's about 10 to 14 days of symptoms is about when you would do that. If you do it before that, which we prescribe way more antibiotics than we should as physicians across the board. And I try to be judicial with that. Now, there are some patients that they've got terrible anatomy. They've been looked at. They've been scoped by ENT. But usually it's like that 10 to 14 days because a lot of the other ones, and you're doing all the right things, by the way, to try to increase that discharge of normal mucus. So, but generally speaking, if you look at the guidelines, 10 to 14 days is sort of the break point. All right. Thank you, Aaron. That's all the time that we have for today. I want to thank all of our callers. If you have a question that you have, you can always email us. Southern Remedies, a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio, and is funded in part by a grant from the University of Mississippi Medical Center. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, professor of internal medicine and pediatrics at UMMC. Southern Remedy was engineered today by Jermaine Flood. Tune in to MPB Think Radio every weekday morning at 11 for the full Southern Remedy lineup.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.